Blog Talk Radio.
Made some of the most beloved and revered films in the history of cinema, The Godfather Trilogy, The Conversation, Apocalypse Now, just to name a few. He is undeniably one of the giants of the cinematic medium, always pushing the envelope in terms of what can be achieved on the technical side, while at the same time maintaining a breathtaking, classical sense of story worthy of Shakespeare. His work and his undeniable passion for the art form have inspired countless filmmakers, and for many movie lovers, his films are an essential stitch in the fabric of their lives. So it may surprise you to know that Francis Ford Coppola still considers himself a student. Witness the creative rebirth he's enjoyed with his last two films, the searching philosophical puzzle Youth Without Youth, and his latest, Tetro, which draws upon the subject closest to his heart, family. Tetro, which opens in theaters on Thursday, June 11th, is his most personal exploration yet, and as he called it in one recent interview, the most beautiful film he's ever made. The Movie Geeks had the honor of speaking with Mr. Coppola about this new film and the personal passions and curiosities that inspired it.
Hola. Pedro, are you awake? Your brother is here. He really doesn't want to know his family anymore.
You stay 1 week.
Thanks, Angie.
Angie's dead. My name is Tetro.
Hola, es Tetro. ¿Cómo estás?
¡José!
¿Qué pasa? ¡No, papá!
¡No!
¡No! ¡No! ¡No! ¡No!
Actually, they're very much in love.
That's love?
People around here don't know much about me. I'd like to keep it that way. Miranda doesn't even know who our father is.
When I met him, he said he was a writer, and he held everything he had written against his friends.
So what was it about?
Rivalry.
You're writing the story of our father.
There's only room for one genius in this family.
Don't you love them? You know what love is in a family like ours, Ben? A quick stab in the heart.
He's like a genius without enough accomplishment.
Good!
Why'd you come here, Benny?
You know, everything that I love or that I'm interested in, I picked up from you. You left me and I didn't even get, like, an explanation.
How did you find this?
It was an accident.
An accident?
How could
you do this to me? My story! Where'd you get to? They're great stories. They don't have an ending.
There doesn't have to be an ending, Benny.
What has happened to our family?
Rivalry.
This is your first original screenplay since The Conversation, I believe. Has this story been percolating for a while for you?
You know, not entirely. I mean, I think there are a lot of elements about the story that I didn't even realize were there. I just felt at this point I wanted to make a kind of more emotional film. I always love those heartbreaking films I've seen from the past, you know, and my last film was Youth Without Youth, which was a little more philosophical, and I thought, God, you know, people don't want to see films about philosophical concepts. They want to feel something. So I thought, well, gee, to do that, I'd have to find a subject matter that makes me more emotional, and that inevitably takes you back to your family, I think.
Yeah. And that's what has always moved me so much about so many of your films, that sense of family. And with Tetro, was there something particular you wanted to explore about the family dynamic?
Well, you know, it was a family loved each other and had a lot of memories, because we moved around a lot. And when you move often, you know, in some cases every 6 or 8 months, all you have is your family, your brother, your sister, your parents, because you haven't made friends yet at school.
Yeah.
And I found myself thinking back to those days and took one step and then another. And in a way, the script sort of wrote itself.
But there is also, if I'm not mistaken, at least most obviously stylistically, a connection to Rumblefish. It almost feels like a close relative to Rumblefish. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's true. I think Rumblefish, although it was from a novel by Susie Hinton, who wrote The Outsiders, it was a story of two brothers, one younger brother who idolized an older brother who sort of disappeared. And maybe when I made that story, I sort of was using the same equipment that then I wanted to, come back again and look more specifically in an original screenplay what that was about, why it seems to have such an effect on me when I think of those days.
Yeah. This seems to be such an exciting time for you. And this is what most interests me about this stage of your career, because you've talked about a creative rebirth that you've been feeling as a filmmaker. And I'm wondering how the process is different for you now when you go out and you create a Tetro. How is that process different from, say, earlier on in your career with Godfather Apocalypse?
Well, when I began, you know, when I was in my 20s or early 20s, really, I like many young people, I wanted to have a career and even hoped that I could make films and make my living that way. And I wanted a family very much, and I was lucky to have I was married about 22, and I had kids right away, which I enjoyed very much. But a career was something I aspired to, and I didn't have any money or any fortune left to me, but I did have this creative tradition in the family.
Mm-hmm.
And I pursued a very colorful and interesting career. It certainly was, in some ways, much more successful, thanks to The Godfather, than I ever thought I would be. But as I thought about things in my middle 60s, I realized that in a funny way I hadn't gotten to do what I really thought I would do or wanted to do, which was to make more personal films, albeit less important films and certainly cheaper films.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sort of came upon a set of guiding rules for if I could possibly have a second career, which would be that it would be always scripts that I had written. That I would make not only scripts that I had written, but stories also that were my own. And my other career, my first career, I was, you know, very often asked to adapt a novel or given a script. There was a period where when I was making a lot of films in order to partly to pay back an enormous bank debt from also financing some of my films.
Right.
Very often I'd be given a script and a star and say, okay, just go direct this, like many directors do. And so in the second chance, I thought, well, one rule is that I'll finance them myself, which means they'll be less expensive, because I believe that the lower the budget, the more ambitious the ideas or more free the ideas can be. Obviously, when you're making a very big, expensive picture, you have to make a very a film that will be enjoyed by, you know, a very widespread audience everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that tends to affect what you can do, and that it would always be something that I had written and always be a screenplay I had written, and you know, kind of go off in it with another set of rules or givens, and that would take me in other areas than I had ever been in the first career. So this is like my second film of my second career.
And some of those early films, obviously, we all know the stories. Some of them were made under tremendous angst and tension. But now you have no studio execs breathing down your neck. You don't have to deal with a lot of those petty problems. But does it feel more fulfilling now that you feel like you're making the types of movies you were born to make in a way?
Well, you know, I think every film director, certainly colleagues of my age, deep down in their heart, you know, live with fear that, oh, they're not going to ever be able to make another film, that, you know, should the last film you make not be successful or not return its investment, you worry that you'll maybe never get the chance again. I used to, when I was a kid, I used to read about Ingmar Bergman going off to his island and just every year or so making films with his friends, and he felt assured that he'd at least be able to make one film after another.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe it's my own anxiety, but I think it's all film directors have this anxiety that it's such a privileged position to be in, to get to make a motion picture, that you worry that, you know, if you don't come across or succeed, you're not going to be able to do it anymore. And so I do feel more sanguine that I can be, you know, I'm sitting here, the Tetro is done, it'll be out on June 11th, and, you know, I feel, God, what a great spot I'm in. I can now sit and write something else, and I'm beginning that, and more or less know that I'm going to be able to make it, rather than you know, as I did with the conversation script, go hat in hand and beg people to let me make it, and ultimately no one would. It was only after The Godfather's success that I got to make that film.
Yes.
Mr. Call, this is Martin Stitt.
How'd you get this phone number?
We prepare a full dossier on everyone who comes in contact with the director. You know, that means we've been watching you. We have the tapes. They're perfectly safe. The director was very anxious to hear them as soon as possible, and you seem to be, I don't know, disturbed. I couldn't take the chance that you might destroy our tapes. You understand? Don't you, Mr. Cole? Our tapes have nothing to do with you. Why don't you come over now and bring the photographs?
Yes,
the director's here, and he's prepared to pay you in full.
You've always been, at least growing up, you've always been on the cutting edge of technology in terms of filmmaking. And I was curious, so much has happened in between your last film and Youth Without You, and technology-wise, I was just wondering, has this been very liberating for you, the new technology, with your return to filmmaking?
Well, you know, it's true that some 30, 40 years ago, myself and my colleagues, Walter Murch, George Lucas, we knew that the filmmaking would one day become an electronic medium. It just seemed like the writing was on the wall, and of course it began in the very long ago in the soundtracks being recorded on tape without perforations. That doesn't maybe sound too significant, but back in the old days, the sound guys would say, I don't care what you say, if it doesn't have perforations in it, it's not going to be in sync. And the the sound was recorded on a thing that sort of looked like magnetic film with little holes in it to hold it in registration. And then that was replaced by electronic perforations in a way. And then after that came electronic editing, which again people said, that will never happen. And yet suddenly everybody was editing their films basically on computers. And the next and final step is to have the actual images be electronic images, and then the projector in your theater be electronic. So this brings with it a tremendous amount of freedom that makes it possible for all the extraordinary digital effects and 3D animation that you're all familiar with and that's so important to modern popular films, but you know, also to approach the language of film too, that you can edit in a in a much more composing way. The way you work with sound, you can now work with picture. So I think we live now in an era where the technology is really a servant of the filmmaker. The filmmaker can pretty much do anything that he or she could imagine.
Well, speaking of computers, and I'm very glad to hear you say that the technology should be the servant, not the other way around. I am curious, though, if today you were going to make something like Apocalypse Now, would you still shoot on location, or would you give in more to doing a lot of it on the computer, a lot of more the effects and everything?
Well, that's an interesting question, because a lot of my thinking and my my conviction that the cinema was going to be electronic came from sitting in the mud for hours upon hours waiting for the helicopters to arrive and being frustrated because, you know, the pilots of those helicopters were afraid of the explosions that were going on below, so they were usually, you know, 10 feet higher than they were supposed to be. And any shot of Apocalypse Now where you see a lot of helicopters, you've got to realize that there were another 10 higher than you could see because they were afraid to come down low. So there were many frustrations, and of course the impact of the economic, you know, the financial implications were so great that probably one wouldn't attempt a movie like that today,
right?
Without benefiting greatly.
Do you know what the man's saying?
Those are the problems with direct
dialectics. This is dialectics. Very simple dialectics. 1 through 9. No maybes, no supposes, no fractions. You can't travel in space. You can't go out into space, you know, without, like, you know, with fractions. What are you going to land on? 1/4, 3/8? What are you going to do when you go from here to Venus or something? That's dialectic physics, okay? Dialectic logic is there's only love and hate. You either love somebody or you hate them.
You know, the use of effects and all the bag of tricks that you have at your fingertips today doesn't have to be in your face effects. They can be subtle and they can they can be very convincing. But certainly in the days of war movies like Apocalypse or even Patton, before it, everything was done for real. I think the first time I saw the implication of what could be done in a new way of thinking was when Stanley Kubrick did Spartacus, and there's a famous sequence where the Roman legions are advancing, and a whole group of them advance and then stop, and then a whole other group of them advance and stop, and that wasn't done electronically. It was done, you know, with optical printing, but it showed how you could manipulate a big crowd scenes in a way that would save, you know, a trillion extras, and the die was cast, I think, at that moment. And in answer to your question, you know, I don't know. Deep down in my heart, I there are some films I'd love to make if it were possible to finance such a big production. And there's one story in particular that a biographical story that, who knows, when I'm 85 years old, should I be lucky enough to live that long, I would have to direct on a donkey in order to get up and down the hills. That one, I think, I would do without the. You know, there is no movie made today that doesn't in some way benefit from digital effects. Even when you don't see it or notice it, it's just there, and it's a servant,
right?
And it's become cheaper and cheaper every day,
right,
to use it. You know, 15 years ago, it was a big deal to use a digital effect or a compositing effect to take the sky out and remove the television antennas, but now it's really a modest cost, and everyone is doing it.
Yeah, now it's another tool in the artist paint box. It's
for sure, and it's a miracle. It's a wonderful era right now, in terms of where the technology has become comfortable. Even the projectors for movie theaters. You know, we struggle to get a black and white film print to look as good as the present generation of electronic projection that's going to sweep through all the theaters, already is sweeping through all the theaters. Many benefits will accrue to it. You know, it doesn't have to be misused as people are fearful of.
Right. Okay.
With Tetro, I know that you had a triumphant return to Cannes. with the film, and you've nurtured it obviously from conception to birth. But after a while, a film becomes its own unique thing, a living thing. And I'm wondering, when you look at it now, what about it surprises you or delights you in particular?
Gosh, that's an interesting question. We had a wonderful reception. It was mainly in the part of Cannes that's more dedicated to younger and independent films, and it was one of the better theater. You know, my films have always, in their time when they came out, with the exception of the first Godfather, usually are controversial, and you get people hating them. And, you know, I'm thinking of Apocalypse Now and other films that later benefited by time. Mm-hmm. You know, when you make a work and you put it out there into the universe, you never know what it is you've started and how people are going to take it and how it might inspire another person to make even a far greater work. You're just sort of putting it in the stream and it goes out there and you're never sure. Tetro is so recent that the film only has been really done the last 3-4 weeks, and you know, I think it's I feel it's a heartfelt and a handmade film. By handmade, I mean it was, you know, because we didn't have tons of money, everything we sort of did by hand, as it were, and not that certainly all films are handmade, because each one is a one-off, but they are produced in a production system, the bigger ones that tend to, you know, it's one size fits all. There's a production method that makes most films that is extremely efficient, I guess, and so everyone uses it. Whereas my way of making films now is much more according to a production method that I cooked up, because it's possible for me to make them self-financed. You know, but, you know, every film could be made with a slightly different production philosophy. I mean, you could take 10-year-olds and say, okay, you're the costume designer, you're the cameraman, here's your camera, and you're the editor, and go out. And depending on what the theme and subject matter is, that might make a film with a wonderful style, but that's limited. That's only good for a couple of kinds of films, whereas in the film industry, they need a method with their very complex, but their hierarchical form of line producers and, it's like the army, you know, this person answers to that person. And that tends to be the best way to make the films in the film industry. But certainly, you know, you can invent a system that might be really good for one film, you know, and then that would be it.
Yeah.
I've invented a production method that really works well for what I want to do, which is to write original scripts and finance them themselves. So I tend to go off to a country where the exchange rate is not unfavorable, meaning I can't afford with my dollars to go to a country that has like a euro or a pound that is so, I wouldn't even be able to afford to hire people. I tend to try to find a country where there's a good rate and also that has a good creative and artistic heritage, so that there's theater and actors, because, you know, obviously one of the big expenses of making a film are plane tickets and hotel rooms and, you know, all of the food and gasoline, all the normal things. So if you make a film somewhere that and all your crew comes from there, they can all go home at night. They don't have to be flown there or put into a hotel. So there's a whole list of just common sense things that make it possible for me to self-finance a movie. And when you can self-finance a movie, then you save other money, because there are many legal requirements. When you go to someone, a studio or a financier, and say, oh, give me money for the film, he wants certain legal guarantees, and they want what are known as completion bonds, which is like an insurance policy to ensure that the film will be finished. And those are all costly, and if I can do away with them, then I can save that money and put it, you know, more where you see it in the film.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I know your time is very valuable. Let us get off like one more question each.
No, I'm happy. I tend to get interested in these questions.
I'm fascinated. I could talk to you for days. Jerry, go ahead if you have another
question. I have a question. Just going back over the body of your work, your characters, a lot of your major protagonists, at least going way back to Michael Corleone, Walter E. Kurtz, the characters in The Rainmaker, even Dracula, they embrace or find themselves in solitude and isolation. And you are so connected and you're such a family man. Do you still embrace this solitude?
You know, I think we're always prisoners of what our lives were like when we were kids, and for whatever reason, my father tended to sell our homes every 6 months. I think he was speculating in real estate on the side. You know, he's a musician. But I just have, we were always moving to another place, and I was going to a new school very often in the middle of the term, and I went to 24 schools before I ever got to college, which was the only school. I went to Hofstra College in Long Island. I went there for 4 years. But before that, I went to 6 high schools. I it's not totally understandable why he did that, but he did. And so as a result, I never really had friends, because, you know, it takes a while to be the new kid at school, especially when your name is Francis. And I never much had friends. Then when I was about 9, I had polio, and I was taken out of school for a year and a half. I was paralyzed. And so as a child, I learned to be alone a lot and kind of entertain myself with reading. And I was like a boy scientist making experimentations, reading about the lives of the great scientists. I loved doing that. And playing with electrical gadgets in the basement, and I just cooked up. I was sad. I was lonely, and I wanted to have friends. And then later, when I was in a position by working in theater, older, to have friends, but that was nice. But now, as an older man, I realize I'm extremely comfortable with being alone. I don't mind it. I can, you know, occupy myself, entertain myself, because
get a lot
I think
done.
There's an advantage to that. But that was so my desire to have kids when I was young and have a family and a marriage. I wanted to get married when I was 21. I was looking to get married and have kids. And I think that was a reaction to what I had. Been a lonely, 14-year-old kind of thing.
Right. One of the things that inspires me about you, and so many things do, your passion is just incredible, and it hasn't waned over all these years either. But also the idea that you say that you want to continue learning as a filmmaker. And in terms of Tetro, what did that experience teach you?
Well, I believe when you write an original story or an original script, unless you're doing it to have a bestseller, you know, sometimes people need to. I know Mario Puzo wrote The Godfather because he was broke and he had a family, and he thought he might be able to make some money with it. But I can see, although I must confess, everything I've ever done in my life to try to make money, it hasn't worked. and the things that I have made a lot of money with, as I have in the hotel business and the wine business in more recent years, just I didn't intend to. It just was I was just doing something that I liked or pursuing, you know. So, basically, I think what I've found now at my age is that the real pleasure of life is to learn that you know, whatever it may be about, that if you can really learn something every day, it's very enjoyable. And there are a lot of other pleasures in life that are flashier and stuff, but they tend to wear thin after a while. But
mm-hmm.
really learning something about a subject matter that you're interested in. And so when you write a script, I feel it's sort of like asking a question. And you and when you make the film, if should you be lucky enough to make the film, you get the answer in one, sometimes very surprising. And I've noticed in these last two films that I worked on, writing the script for The Youth Without Youth and then Tetro, in both cases I came away learning a lot about what I didn't know when I wrote the script. Of course, as you can imagine, that makes it very hard to go get sponsorship, because you can't go to a studio or a financier and say, look, here's a script, but I don't really know exactly what it means. I'm going to learn that after the film is done. You know,
exactly.
To say, well, come back when you know what you're doing, because this is a business.
Right.
But when you're financing it yourself, you can a little bit take that risk. And on Tetro, I learned a lot of things about myself, why some of those subject matter or some of those thoughts that happened in that story were so emotional to me. I learned, even though I didn't realize it before I made the film, you know, and this is, we're talking about things that happened 60 years ago or 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I find in life that any passion or any obsession you have, or inexplicably, even if you go toward it and look at it and in some way indulge it, it tends to go away, or it tends to change, you know. You shouldn't be afraid of your, you know, even passions that you think are disturbing. I don't mean that you should go and murder people if that's what you're but if metaphorically, if you had that fear and you went toward it in some sort of acceptable, socially acceptable way, I bet you it would transition into something else that you'd be surprised.
I know you get this a lot, but just to close off here, I got to tell you, from all of us, you've made such a difference in our lives, your work, and
yeah.
It's such an honor to have the opportunity to speak to you, and I hope we get to do it again soon.
Thank you so much, and you know, for my part, you know, we're all in the same boat, and we all have our insecurities and stuff, and I think, you know, I think it's good to head toward what those things we want to do and not postpone them you know, do it all, because then that's what we call living. So thanks again, and thanks for
thank
your
you.
Interest.
Thank,
okay.
Thank you so much, sir. Have
goodbye.
A good day.
Goodbye. You too. Bye-bye.
Unflinching, tough, big-hearted. These are just a few words that describe both the man and his resume of exceptional works, a breathtaking resume that includes screenplays for Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, The Last Temptation of Christ, The Mosquito Coast, Bringing Out the Dead, and directorial efforts like Blue Collar, Hardcore, Affliction, Autofocus, American Gigolo, Light of Day, and Cat People. And film after film, his keen understanding of drama and his daring and insightful views on the human condition leave no doubt that you are in the hands of a great artist. His recent film, The Walker, starring Woody Harrelson, hits DVD on May 27th. Criterion is currently prepping a gorgeous rendering of his 1985 classic Mishima, A Life in Four Chapters, for a June 24th release. He has a brand new website at paulschrader.org, where you can find his resume of great works, as well as a comprehensive library from his early work as a film critic. And you can catch his next film, Adam Resurrected, with Jeff Goldblum and Willem Dafoe, I believe, we'll verify this, later this year. It is truly a great honor to welcome someone who has given so much to the world of cinema and to film fans all around the globe, Mr. Paul Schrader. Mr. Schrader, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Thank you so much for being here. I can't tell you how honored we are to have you.
Yes, welcome.
I'm talking to Jamie.
And Jerry.
I am Jamie, and Jerry's here with me.
All right. Where are you, in, like, Mumbai or something?
No.
We're actually at different locations. It's the magic of the internet. I am in Florida. Jerry's in Maryland, and our show was given a New York number.
So there we go.
There you have it. I wanted to start out by talking to you about. I know that you weren't. It's written. It's common knowledge that you weren't allowed to see films growing up. But were you at least exposed to the art of storytelling at a young age that sparked some kind of creative ambition?
Yeah, well, it wasn't just me. It was our entire church. So I didn't know anybody who saw movies, so I didn't exactly feel deprived because movies were outside of our realm of experience.
Sure.
Which, actually looking back, wasn't a bad thing at all, since it forced us to rely on an older and perhaps better form of storytelling, which is the kind around the kitchen table.
Yeah.
And my relatives, my uncles in particular, were great storytellers. And so I remember as a kid just sitting around listening to these kind of endless yarns and being captivated by it. And you know, to be honest, you know, that's probably a better training than watching endless episodes of CSI where the same plots are recycled.
Right.
Finally, when you get to be 22 years old, you've now seen 20,000 hours of narrative, and there's nothing left to entrance you.
Yeah.
Very true.
But did you feel a need to write at a young age? Did you write a lot as a youngster?
I wanted to get it out there. So the first fantasy, of course, was to be a minister. And so I went door to door, and I was one of those kids who would bug you door to door and give you leaflets and ask about the condition of your soul. And then I lost that lot of its attraction, and I read about Clarence Darrow. I thought, oh, that's what I can be. But then, of course, I realized I couldn't get along with people well enough. And that only left being a writer, where you didn't even have to get along with people. And so I started writing basically journalism. And then luckily enough, along comes 1966, and that whole world explodes. And being a journalist is all of a sudden being politically active.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very exciting time.
But correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I recall reading a quote from you where you said that if you had to choose over again, you might not necessarily pick cinema as your art form of choice. You know, is there something limiting about filmmaking find?
That's a slight misquote.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
If I had to choose back then, I would make the same choice. If I had to choose today, I would not choose movies because I think movies are over. But that's another discussion, probably one that your listeners don't want to hear.
No, we can get into that.
That's a huge conversation there. Maybe we'll save that one for a little while, but I am definitely interested in exploring that some before we let you go. But your early days in film criticism and your relationship with Pauline Kael, who we're also crazy about on this show, the impression I get from her is she kind of was as she wrote. She was funny, challenging, and acerbic, but kind of hard to resist. Is that how you found her?
Yeah, I mean, she was tough, you know.
Yeah.
And she sort of plucked me out of nowhere. I was taking some summer courses at Columbia. I'd taken some time off from Calvin College, my college, because I hadn't seen any movies, and I was getting interested in movies, and of course we didn't show movies at Calvin. So I spent a summer at Columbia, and through meeting somebody in a bar at night who happened to know her, and the next thing I know, I'm in her apartment, and the next thing I know, I'm staying over on her couch because we talked all night long, and the next thing I know, the next morning, she's saying to me, we're going to stay in touch, and you're not going to be a minister, you're going to be a film critic.
Wow.
So that sort of turned my life around, and she got me into UCLA grad film school, and you know, without that kind of serendipitous meeting, I certainly wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now.
Well, looking through your website and reading some of those early reviews, they're just fantastic, and much like Pauline Kael's work that we're all so in awe of. But today it seems a little different. I mean, do you sense less and less relevance or merit in the film criticism of today? It's more like Consumer Reports today. But
well,
you've
touched on a pretty big subject.
Yeah.
And, you know, why has, you know, the horse of movies fallen down? You know, and there's four legs on that horse, and one of them is audiences, and one is critics, and one is filmmakers, and one is financiers.
Right.
And when that horse falls down, one leg can't get it standing up again.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the collapse of relevant film criticism, and it's not a total collapse, there's still a lot of good people out there.
Oh,
right.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
But the importance of criticism is just mirrored by the collapse in all the other sectors. You know, movies simply do not have the place in our society that they did 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, they've been relatively marginalized. And that is just a product of changing times, but also, more importantly, changing media.
Mm-hmm. Well, now that we've touched on this the second time, let's go ahead and explore it.
I'm dying to hear this.
Yeah, this is the elephant in the room.
Yeah.
Now, everything comes in kind of waves. I mean, the new Hollywood, the Hollywood Renaissance, of which you were such a critical part in the 70s. Do you think that we'll ever get to that place again, or do you think it's a point of no return that we're at?
No, that's gone. You know, what's interesting about the moment we find ourselves in now is that when I came into films, late 60s, it was a moment of crisis, but it was a crisis of content. People didn't know what movies were about. They realized they couldn't be about what they used to be about, but what were they about? And then people started making films about different things. You know, along came Easy Rider, and along came Last Picture Show, and all of a sudden you realize that you can make films about these subjects. And it changed the American film industry. And it ushered in, actually, a very wonderful period of filmmaking. We're in a similar period of crisis now. Unfortunately, the nature of the crisis is not what movies about, but what are movies.
Mm.
We no longer know what movies are. We don't know how long they are. We don't know where you watch them. You don't know whether you interact with them. You don't know whether, essentially, whether they have narrative or not. I mean,
right.
And it's very exciting creatively, but movies are morphing into something else. And like yesterday, I went to the movies, and I saw The Bank Job, and I saw three movies. I saw Boleyn Girl, and then I saw Paranoid Park.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the last movie. I said, well, there's a movie that was made now. You know, that's sort of what's happening now.
Right.
And so we are trying to figure out what the movies are. The producer of the film before my last film, who had produced 10 films, has left the producing business and now has a website where he has contests and he makes 3-minute movies for cell phones.
Mm-hmm.
This is a guy with you know, a whole string of credits.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's how big the paradigm shift we're facing is right now. And it is kind of fascinating. I just finished the script, and it had a lot of kind of sexual material. It was about three nights in the life of an escort and her driver. And I thought to myself, I was going to write it feature length, and I was going to write it R-rated, because that's the tradition I come from.
Right.
And I thought, wait a second, why am I making this R? There is no R anymore. You know, theaters are on their way out.
Right.
Why don't I just make it hardcore? Because that's what the material is. I mean, it's about a girl who goes into assignations all night long. But why don't you just write what's happening? And why does it have to be an hour and a half, 2 hours? Maybe it's 320 minutes. And so I wrote this script, and it ended up being 320 minutes, and it ended up being unrated. And I thought, well, we'll make it for 400 grand, and and it's a very kind of a cheap movie, and we'll set up a website, and we'll sell it on the web. So mm-hmm. if that's happening to me, and God knows, you know, I'm an old fart, if that's what's going on in my head, you can imagine what's going on in the heads of people who are, you know, 40 years younger than I am.
Yeah. Well, you're talking about this influx of new media, but how movies as we have known them are kind of losing their identity.
Right.
But doesn't it open up a flood of new options, and do you sense that movies no longer matter? Is that part of what you're sensing?
No. Well, audiovisual entertainment is, you know, in our bloodstreams, and it is as hard as it is for someone of my generation to conceive of a movie being watched on a cell phone in 3-minute segments. That may be part of the new mix of what AV is, and maybe that word AV will start to replace the word movies,
mm-hmm.
because movies we think of as a 2-hour experience you sit in the theater and watch in the dark.
Yeah,
and time is not on the side of the movies, but it will always be on the side of storytelling, and as storytelling has progressed now as an audiovisual medium.
Yeah, yeah.
Excuse
well,
me.
Well, I'm 34, and I dread the day that we're relegated to watching films on the cell phone.
Yes, so do I.
Absolutely with you.
But Mr. Schrader, do you think the theater going experience will become obsolete?
No, but it will start to mirror more and more the theatrical experience. It will become more of an event.
You think it will be like the preview, basically the movie, the going to the theater is almost going to be like just an incredibly expensive ad for the DVD.
Well, there won't be DVDs.
So oh, that, yeah, that's yeah. true. That's going to go, too.
Within 3 years, 4 years, DVDs are gone. You know, you can put them right next to your CDs.
Oh, great. Okay. I'm losing money by the day here.
But we do see that today. We do see that today where people don't want to pluck down $15 for a film unless they're going to be wowed like they're at an amusement park.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been happening for yeah. you know over 2 decades now.
Yeah.
And well, here's another interesting phenomenon. We're now creating a generation of young people who don't think they should pay for entertainment. Why
yeah.
should I pay
yeah.
for music?
Mm-hmm.
Music is in the air. Music is free. Music is file shared. It started with music. Now it's happening with pornography. The web is full of...
Well, didn't the pornography come first, though, the free... That came before the music.
No, not free pornography.
Oh, okay.
Pornography is now free. The web is full of watch me and my girlfriend websites.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so all of a sudden, now, well, we don't need to pay for music. We don't need to pay for porn. Why should we pay for movies?
And you can't stop that. Once that genie's out of the bottle, you're never going to be able to enforce that.
Yeah, and you can make music and you can make porn in your living room. It's
you can do
hard
anything.
Yeah.
I mean,
God knows I do both.
Okay,
yeah.
So this is the whole. This comes from the punk movement, the do-it-yourself movement. The internet is sort of the ultimate realization of this.
So it's awfully hard to make, you know, movies of scale in your living room.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's true. That's
even with those little toy soldiers.
Well, if you'll permit us to go back through some of the great films that do grace your resume, well, we were talking about the film criticism. I want to know, are you able to apply that same kind of critical thinking to your own work from your early days as a critic?
I try not to. It's rough because I am, you know, basically an analytical person.
Yeah.
But, you know, a film critic is in many ways like a medical examiner. You know, he looks at the body and tries to explain how and why it lived and whether its life had any value. A filmmaker is like a pregnant woman. You know, she's just trying to give birth to this thing.
Yeah.
And if you let that medical examiner half of you into the birthing room, he will kill that baby.
Oh, that is beautifully stated. Yeah.
So you've got to keep him out because he's not interested in seeing that baby live. He's just interested in dissecting it.
But if you look back at your career, are there films that you can see and you can see, yeah, that presents a major period of growth for me? Or is it a mistake to take out any title and single out any title in particular?
Well, I mean, look, they don't all work. And there are lesser and greater successes and lesser and greater failures. And, you know, you try not to, you know, advertise your failures too much because occasionally you run into people who actually think they're good. And at which point you just bite your lip and look
right.
at your shoes and say thank you.
Right.
In my mind, I know which ones work and I know which ones failed and I sort of know why. And the hardest part is when you're actually in the process of doing it, keeping yourself from overanalyzing it. Because, you know, it's a living, breathing, kind of mutating thing. It changes right in front of your eyes. And you have to walk, every day you have to walk on the set or over to the keyboard with an absolutely open mind.
Yeah, and you say that it's such a living thing. Isn't the outcome of a great movie... isn't it kind of not to be defined in a way? I mean, I look at Taxi Driver, and we brought this up Wednesday. A great screenplay, great star, great director. But there was something else that makes this a timeless movie, some kind of indefinable chemistry where you all were living in that place.
Well, it's called the Zeitgeist. You know,
yeah.
I mean, the three of us happened to meet at the right time in our lives,
mm-hmm.
but we also met in the right time sociologically. And we were, you know, on the cusp and fearless without even knowing how fearless we were because it felt so real, so right. And, you know, occasionally you get lucky that way.
In terms of Taxi Driver, I mean, there's such it seems like you all were just so... so hungry to explore that world. I'm wondering how much of a presence were you on that set?
Not much because I was already beginning to direct my first film.
Sure.
I was there during pre-production, and we rewrote the script a bit during pre-production. And I think I visited the set twice while shooting.
Only twice, okay.
But I was in Los Angeles working, trying to set up Blue Collar at that time.
Sure.
And also, I happen to believe that by the time a director is making a film, if the writer hasn't gotten it right, he never will. And it no longer belongs to him anymore. And Bobby called me once from the set, and he said, you know, I was thinking, you know, do you think Travis would say this in a scene he was going to do the next day? And I said, Bobby, you know, you're in New York. I'm in L.A. You're wearing my shirt and my boots, which he was.
Yeah.
You're making the film. If you think this character would say that, he probably would.
Oh my God, that's a beautiful little touch. Nickel-plated, snub nose. Otherwise, the same as a service revolver. That'll stop anything that moves. Magnum, they use that in Africa for killing elephants. That 38... that's a fine gun. Some of these guns are like toys. That's 38. You go out and hammer nails with it all day, come back and it'll cut dead center on target every time. It's got a really nice action to it, and a heck of a wallop. You interested in an automatic? It's a Colt 25 automatic. It's a nice little gun. It's a beautiful little gun. Holds six shots in a clip, One shot in the chamber. If you're dumb enough to put a round in the chamber. Here, look at this. 380 Warfa. Holds 8 shots in the clip. That's a nice gun. And that's a beautiful little gun, look at that.
How much for everything?
All together. Well, only a jackass would carry that cannon in the streets like that. Here. Here's a beautiful handmade holster I had made in Mexico. $40. $350 for the Magnum, $250 for the .38, $1.25 for the .25, $150 for the .380. You take this. Oh, wait here, I'll walk down with you. How about dope? Grass, ash, coke, mescaline, downers, nebutol, toluol, chloral hydrate. How about uppers, amphetamines?
No, I'm not interested in that stuff.
Crystal meth. I can get you crystal meth. Nitrous oxide. How about that? How about a Cadillac? I get you a brand new Cadillac with the pink slip for $2,000.
If the actor is in the zone and the director is in the zone, they don't need the writer anymore. They're now living the life.
Right.
I completely. If I can ask real quick, I know that you're often asked about a sequel to Taxi Driver, and I think you've pretty much shot it down and said that that's not a possibility, but. In a way, do you feel that Bringing Out the Dead is kind of the closest thing we have to a sequel to Taxi Driver?
Well, yeah. I mean, unfortunately, it was written for a young person, and circumstances prevailed, and an actor was cast who was 10 years too old. So it didn't have the buzz that it should have,
mm-hmm.
which would have given it that Taxi Driver buzz.
Yeah.
You had a kind of a midlife guy having an adolescent crisis.
Yes.
Okay.
But I do feel like a kind of kind of an arc, kind of a full circle between that and Taxi Driver, and kind of a maturity as well. We talked about it on Wednesday's show, whereas Taxi Driver, the only release, the only orgasm, if you will, that this character can enjoy is an act of violence. And Bring Out the Dead, all he wants is peace, and he seems to be coming from that same place as Bickle did. Do you sense that? I mean, did you craft it like that?
Yeah, I mean, you try not to get too on the nose.
Yeah.
You know, I've written these 4 scripts, which I think in my mind are sort of linked, which is Taxi Driver, American Gigolo, Light Sleeper, and The Walker.
Yeah.
You know, and a guy 20, 30, 40, 50. And he's a taxi driver, he's a gigolo, he's a drug dealer, and he's a society walker.
Right.
Mm. Now, in most people's minds, there's no real connection with these kind of people. But in my mind, there is. To my mind, that's the evolution of a soul.
Absolutely.
And so that's the kind of artistic glue that makes something cook, because it's not one-to-one. It's sort of 1.5 to 1. And, you know, and whenever there really are connections, if they're 1 to 1, they're not very interesting. They always have to be slightly off to make them interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's a movie of yours that I keep coming back to time and time again. And I watch it at least once a year, and that film is Hardcore. A dynamic performance from George C. Scott, but that wasn't necessarily the most harmonious of relationships, was it?
Well, yeah. Well, there's a lot of George stories, and I could fill up a considerable amount of time with George stories.
Yeah.
and I don't want this to, you know, we'll give this another 15 minutes, but I think then we start to bring it together.
Okay.
If you want to go into George stories, I'll give you a George story though.
That I would be delighted to hear a George story. Whatever you can offer, it'd be great.
Okay, so we are, you know, George is an alcoholic was at the time, and his agent said, you know, in the contract, allot 3 lost days to alcoholism, which we did And surprisingly enough, that we lost 3 days due to alcoholism. So she obviously knew her business. So we're shooting in San Francisco, and we're in the red light district, and it's a Saturday night. And we have a scene that's quite complicated in one direction, which George is not in. Very simple the other direction, which George is in. And so I said to the AD, what should we do? And he said, well, go for the meat. Always go for the meat, meaning shoot the most complicated stuff first.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So we shot that. We dragged George, which was a huge mistake, because that left him in his trailer for three, four hours. So when we turned around the cameras, except for George, I started getting the messages. He won't come. He won't come up. So we sent the second AD, sent the first AD, sent the production manager. The producer happened to be there. We sent the producer. George won't come out. He wants to talk to you. So I go there, and he is sitting in the back of the trailer in his skivvies. And I had another experience with him summerly. When he got drunk, he always tended to take off his clothes. when the first time I met him, he was in a bar, and he was completely nude. He had taken off all his clothes. He was drunk. And so I, as soon as I saw him sitting there in the skivvies, I thought, oh, fuck, he's smashed. so I went over to him and I tried to explain to him that we needed him on the set, blah blah blah, and he said this movie's a piece of shit.
Ugh.
And I said, George, when you're making a movie, sometimes you lose faith, you get a little disillusioned, but in the end, I said, she said, shut up. It's a piece of shit. It's a piece of shit, and you're a piece of shit director.
Oh, no.
He said, you're a good writer, but you're a terrible director. And I sat down with him, and I talked some more, and trying to find a way to... Finally, I said to him, I said, George, we've got... two shots to do with you here tonight. I can combine them into one shot. Now, I'll light the shot, and you can walk right from the trailer, and as soon as you walk in, we'll say action, and you just say these two lines and exit, and then you can go in your car and you go home. If you don't do that, we have to come back here next Monday rather than be in San Diego, and you will have to be on this film two more days. And... that makes up sense to him. So he slapped me on the shoulder and said, okay, good, I'll do it, kid, but only under one condition. I said, well, what's that? He said, you have to promise me that you will never direct another motion picture. And I got on my hands and knees in that trailer and knelt before George and put my hands in the praying position and said, Mr. Scott, I promise you, I will never direct another motion. And he slapped me on the shoulder. He said, good, kid, good. All right, let's go.
Oh, that is a classic.
That is. It's great.
A controversial subject. A brilliant actor. A powerful and touching film. A movie which will take you into a world never dealt with in a major motion picture. A father searches for his missing daughter, only to find she has been used in a sordid and shocking way.
Turn it off!
George C. Scott, Hardcore, rated R. Coming soon to a selected theater near you.
I know you've got like 10 minutes with us. I want to ask about your future. I want to ask about Adam Resurrected and then close with your film canon, because I had a question I was just dying to ask you from that. We have a caller. Let me see if we can take a call real quick with a question for you. 210 area code. Go ahead.
Hey, guys, it's Aaron.
Hey, Aaron.
Hey, Aaron.
Hey, I'm the... Mr. Schrader, this is quite an honor. I'm the home entertainment editor of Movie Geeks United, and it's just an honor to talk to you. I was just wondering, just to bring it back earlier, too, on film criticism, I was wondering what you thought on the current state of criticism, and that so many critics, not only, it seems, not only on mid-level papers, but now it seems to have been reported that... buyouts of major critics like David Anson at Newsweek are occurring, and I was wondering, what do you think of these?
Well, you're confusing two issues. One issue is, the general decline of film criticism.
Right.
The other larger issue is the absolute collapse of the newspaper business.
Right.
Now, the newspaper business is going down in flames.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, who knew when the internet came up that the swath of destruction you know, first came the music business, now the newspaper business, and, you know, who knows, next maybe the movie business.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just wiping out a lot of stuff. But the newspaper business is in the crash and burn mode. So there's a lot of interesting criticism, but, you know, it's spread all over the place. You know, my friend David Kerr, who writes the DVD reviews for the New York Times,
right.
You know, he's got a very interesting website, you know. A lot of James Rosenblum Baum has a website, Roger Ebert's website. You know, there's a lot of interesting criticism going on. There's only a few places left for the heavyweights to work, you know, the David Denbys and the David Aronsons, the Peter Travers of this world. But, you know, the criticism is mutating to the web, which is, you know, unfortunate because it doesn't pay any money. I'm friends with Scott Foundas, who's a critic for LA Weekly and Variety.
Right.
And, you know, Scott can't make a living because there is no economic underpinning for the film criticism business anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, to complete my question, what I was curious is that the Internet has created this new avenue for criticism, and it seems that there is a hunger for discussion of film on the Internet, but it seems that the irony is that now there seems to be no economic incentive for that it seems almost to be truly done out of passion and love for film, for yeah. the medium of film.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's, you know, that's a pity, because, you know, a real working film critic has bills like the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you, Aaron.
For your call. We'll see you next week on the show. Just real quick, this is a fun question. Your film canon that was published in the Film Comment magazine a couple of years ago. Mr. Goldblum, when he was on our show, he talked about the essential films that you gave him to look over, which are films that you return to before you embark on any new work. Rules of the Game, Masculine, Feminine, Tokyo Story. There was a title in the film canon that I am dying to hear your take on. And it's the most recent film on the canon, and that is The Big Lebowski. I'm dying to know Paul Schrader's take on The Big Lebowski.
Yeah, really.
Well, that's a very hard film to make, you know. And, you know, comedy is not easy. And,
no, it's not.
And I mean, good comedy. You know, I mean.
No, that's what I mean. It's hard.
Yeah.
I mean, cock out jokes, or, you know. But I mean, really smart comedy that makes you think while you're laughing. And I think I put in, like, four comedies in that list. I put in a Keaton, a Chaplin. I put in Lady Eve.
Mm.
Maybe the Marx Brothers, maybe not. But then I thought, you know, who's really... And I think Big Lebowski will absolutely stand the test of time, and it will get better and better known and better appreciated. And it's already happening. And it's a rare example of... a comedy that truly has the chops of greatness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And such a comedy of behaviors over a comedy of, you know, punchlines. It's all in the rhythms and the dynamics between those characters. It's amazingly funny. And you're working with Criterion now. Are you working with Criterion on Mishima? How close?
Yeah, well,
I'm
just about finished. It comes out in June now. We've been fooling around with this for almost a year and a half. Doing a new DI for Mishima, adding a scene, doing some sky replacement, and then all the extras and everything. And I'm really glad that we're getting this out. We had to wait 25 years, because after 25 years, the rights reverted from Warner Brothers to Francis Coppola and George Lucas. And
right.
once they got a hold of it, then we were able to sell it to Criterion and have this reissue.
Oh, bless Criterion. They do great work.
Yeah, they do awesome work.
Yes.
I'm going to buy it, even though the DVD is going to become obsolete. I'm going to buy it.
Well, it'll look nice on your shelf.
That's right. That's
great. So tell me where you are with Adam Resurrected. We heard from Mr. Goldblum about that film. It sounds like an incredibly challenging, exciting project.
I have a good feeling about that film. It is very, very bold, very unique, and it is a kind of above the fold movie.
Yeah.
You know, there's a phrase in the newspaper business, a story is above the fold or below the fold.
Right.
And a film like The Walker is kind of a below the fold movie, but Adam is definitely above the fold. It's kind of a big subject and a very bold undertaking, and you know, Jeff gives, you know, the performance that he has spent his whole life preparing to give.
That's the sense I get, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so, but we are done with it now. I haven't seen a final print yet. It's because we just finished a few days ago in Germany. But it, creatively, we're done.
But are you thinking that we might see it in the fall, perhaps? Or?
Well, this was a film that was entirely equity financed. A man from Germany and a man from Israel. And we shot it in Romania and in Israel. And so there is no studio involved.
Okay.
So now the calculation is how to take it into market, how to sell it, you know,
right.
Who to sell it to. But, you know, common sense dictates that it is a sort of end of the year kind of serious awards type film. So I would think it would fall into that marketing pattern.
And so I was returned to my home, a home for the survivors of the Nazi camps.
Fellow survivors, it's so good to be back here at the Institute.
You're a brilliant man. Why haven't we been able to help you?
Ladies and gentlemen, Avant-garde!
Here we are. Do not be frightened.
You, the funniest man in Germany.
Make us laugh.
Take your style to Rex's pen. No, Adam, on all fours.
It's funnier that way.
You stay here with me, make me laugh.
My wife and daughters.
Bargaining already, Adam.
Before you cure me, you will all go crazy or since. Let a dog in here.
There's no dog.
How could you? You're the only one that I could talk to in this godforsaken place.
If I had not been able to laugh back there, I would be dead.
Laugh?
No one's been able to get through to him but you.
This is my chance. The King of Dogs. You lived. That's what matters.
Well, when it comes up to release time, we would be honored to welcome you back to the show to speak about
it.
And Mr. Schrader, we think the world of you, my friend.
Yes,
thank you so much for being on our show.
Oh, thank you for asking.
Thank you very much.
All right, no last question now.
I think we can wait until you come back next time. We're good. Thank you so much.
Yeah, bye-bye.
I mentioned director tributes and archive shows. Our loyal listeners may recall a 2.5-hour tribute show we conducted back in July in honor of our first guest tonight. This cinematic icon has been dazzling audiences for much of the past 4 decades, having crafted breathtaking and timeless films like Carrie, Dressed to Kill, Blowout, Scarface, Carlito's Way, The Untouchables, Mission Impossible, and the hauntingly powerful Casualties of War. He has set himself apart as a thoughtful social commentator and a wildly expressive visual storyteller. And like all great artists, his work never fails to challenge, provoke, and inspire. Now, he delivers the most controversial and feverishly debated film of his career. Redacted offers a fictionalized account of a real-life incident involving the rape and murder of a 14-year-old Iraqi girl at the hands of several American soldiers. The film is profoundly moving, confrontational, infuriating, and, in spite of the comments from naysayers, many of whom haven't even bothered to view the film, it is also deeply compassionate.
Now, are you listening to me, soldier?
Yes, sir.
But are you hearing me?
I'm hearing you, Sergeant.
God damn it, boy, you so dog ugly, a bullet to your face would be an improvement.
They don't want to kill us over there in the good old U.S. of A. They want to kill us here.
I was looking at the picture you just sent me of you and the boys. I wish to God I was there instead of here.
This is a joke, right?
Alpha Company will have to temporarily remain here in Samara to man the checkpoints and keep a lid on insurgent traffic.
I mean, what are we doing here?
It is a tremendous honor for the Movie Geeks to welcome to the show one of our greatest inspirations from the world of cinema, Mr. Brian De Palma. Mr. De Palma, hello.
Thank you for that illustrious introduction.
Well, we are so honored to have you with us tonight. And let me say, Chris and I viewed the film the other night, and it is a remarkable piece of work. And I want to get right to it. You know, you've been through a lot of, you've suffered a lot of criticism throughout your career, and even for your thrillers, and I think so unfairly so. But now Redacted is, obviously it's out there now, and it's in the press, and it's being criticized by a lot of people that haven't even seen it. Did you anticipate this kind of firestorm when you embarked on this project, or is it just all old hat for you at this point?
No, I thought I'd be getting into a lot of hot water because I'm presenting a view of the troops that nobody's ever seen before.
Yeah. Well, you've said that the newspaper and the television images that were presented to the American public during Vietnam sparked the uprising to stop that war, and Redacted is in a large part a response to the new media that don't put those images on display as they once did. When did you first notice this kind of sterilization in the media's approach, and how much of a factor do you believe the modern media has on the culture's perception and possible apathy towards the current war?
Well, with the embedded reporters, like, well, first there was the first Gulf War where the reporters never, you know, left the press room, never even got near what was going on. And then the second war, Afghanistan and Iraq, where you're getting reports from embedded reporters, and they just seemed a little whitewashed and more like propaganda rather than what exactly the reality was on the ground.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, if you wanted to get that, you just had to sort of go into the Internet, and you soldiers would be blogging, and there would be pictures. And this is all the stuff I discovered when I was researching the material.
Yeah.
But you know, but the first question always with a director is, yeah, where are the pictures?
Uh-huh.
You know, in Vietnam, we saw all the pictures in Look and Life magazine and on CBS Evening News. There were no pictures.
Yeah.
And what's kind of astounding to me is that administration officials can just sort of lie and it doesn't seem to bother anybody.
That's very true.
They can run clips of them saying the opposite things right next to each other, and nobody seems to be disturbed by that.
It does seem to be one lie after another, and I absolutely don't know when the American outrage is going to start.
It's just amazing to me. Even like tonight on the news, they're reporting, you know, some whistleblowers, AT&T, just, you know, discovers that, you know, they've been bugging everybody's phone, and, you know, it just wasn't international calls. It was everything.
Mm-hmm.
Everything being gone into a sort of a black room and split off to some government agency. And, of course, all they used to say is, oh, no, we're only monitoring calls from abroad to, you know, Middle East countries.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's like a blatant, I mean, you know, it just outrage doesn't seem to matter anymore.
Yeah.
That's very true.
Now, speaking of filmmaking, have you been disappointed by the filmmaking community's creative reaction to this war thus far?
Well, that's bothered me for quite a while. I mean, I had a friend that was sort of, you know, doing an article about, you know, what's going on in, you know, in independent filmmaking, and I said, well, why don't you go to the selection committee at Sundance and see if anybody's making any political films? And she went and found out there were, like, none, you know, like 5-6 years ago. And I'm thinking, God, this is kind of amazing.
Nobody's
disturbed about what's going on in the political, you know, scene in our country. They're just making films about, you know, coming of age and, you know, does Mary love me and, you know, am I a homosexual? You know, it's like one after another, just thinking, well, you know, we're, you know, sort of creating a huge mess in the Middle East, and nobody doesn't seem to bother, you know, young filmmakers at all, which is the antithesis of what happened to me when I started to make movies.
That's just it, because I hate to get on my 70s soapbox, but the 70s were an amazing period for cinema, but there were a lot of films actually that were about something during that time, about what was going on in the world at that time, and we seem to be losing that today.
Well, the thing is that, you know, we could be drafted. So Greetings is basically, how do we avoid the draft?
Yeah.
And that was, you know, that was something you really worried about and figured out all kinds of ways to get out of the draft. And nobody I knew ever went into the Army. But they always found a way to get out. And the people that did go were people that actually wanted to go, you know, like David Rabe or Oliver Stone.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to go and, you know, experience, you know, men at war. But people don't seem to rely on their, you know, basic instincts, you know, that basically say, what are we doing there?
Mm.
And you listen to all the, you know, intellectual mumbo jumbo that they feed you, you know, the domino theory, or the whole world's going communist, and, you know, and you go, well, these countries have been fighting each other for generations. Suddenly they're all going to band together and attack us.
Mm.
It just doesn't make any sense. And this, of course, is the same thing with weapons of mass destruction. I mean, I don't even know who came up with that. It wasn't around like, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago. Nobody even, you know, they came up with this term, and they keep on beating you to death with it to, you know, make you afraid. And this, you know, and I see all these techniques because, you know, I made a lot of fright films, so I'm aware of how you get people scared.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Do you think it's the fact that there is not a draft? Do you think it would take a draft to inspire an uprising and kind of a more widespread protest of this war?
Well, they hide everything. That's what's so amazing about it. And, you know, it's like the whole, you know, incredible debt we're getting into. I mean, you know, everybody's, you know, living on credit, so you don't really feel the, you know, the pain that you did like in the Second World War, and you had to go, you know, buy war bonds. You know, you think, oh, well, this is something we could figure out down the line. But, you know, one day you're going to walk in and, you know, open up the cupboard, and there's going to be nothing there. And,
sure.
And the government will say, oops. Sorry.
Yeah. Jerry, you actually...
Yeah, I have a question.
Yeah.
I first want to say it's like, you know, you're fighting the war, and you're asking people not to sacrifice, and you're having tax cuts. It doesn't make a lot of sense. But I do have a question for you, Mr. De Palma. What's striking to anyone with knowledge of your work is the amazing similarity between the real event depicted in Redacted to the one that you depict in Casualties of War. What made you decide that this was a story you wanted to tell here when you had already explored it before?
Well, I was struck, of course, by the fact that the incidences were so similar. It was like, you know, just like Vietnam is so much, you know, so similar to Iraq. And this type of atrocity happened more or less for the same reasons. And since I had no real firsthand knowledge or couldn't even use any information about the actual perpetrators in this case, I relied on the characters that were created in Casualties of War. And then I just had to find a different way to tell the story. And by researching it, I found all these unique, you know, digital modes on the internet.
Okay, I have just another thing. Do you think that, I noticed in both films, do you think that the rape is a metaphor for the larger issue of imperialism?
No, absolutely. I mean, we're raping a country. I mean, absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, that's why Casualties of War seemed to me the quintessential story about Vietnam. We are raping a country. We are demolishing it. We are destroying it. You know, and
it's a very powerful metaphor. You couldn't pick a more violent metaphor.
Exactly. You know, not only did they rape her and kill her, then they set her on fire. I mean, it's essentially what we're doing to Iraq. You know, and that's what I also felt about Vietnam. I mean, you know, in order to save the village, we have to level the village.
Right.
So it's of course it's a great metaphor, and that's what struck me about Casualties of War, and I took a long time to get it made. These pictures are impossible to get made.
You discussed the visual structure of your film briefly. You're using a variety of media here, from video blogs to YouTube-style clips and surveillance cameras. In Vietnam, I suppose you could claim it was the television war. But do you think that Iraq is becoming the internet version of that? And was that what inspired you to structure the film in this manner?
Well, it's kind of a combination of things. I discovered the forms in the research. Otherwise, I went on the internet and, you know, you put in, you know, Iraq casualties or Iraq U.S. soldiers rape, and you come up with all kinds of stuff, and then you come up with all kinds of people commenting on it, and then you come up with, you know, sites and army wives, you know, and montages of horrendous casualty pictures, and you see all these forms, you know, even the Wild Bill, the rant of the girl late in the film. I mean, that was one of the few things we actually bought. We actually got the rights to use the material that Wild Bill had put on his website.
Right.
That's his material. I just basically dramatized it a little bit, and the best person that read for it was this, you know, very dynamic girl. So, and I'm interested in this form because, you know, I'm kind of a little bored with kind of straightforward filmic, you know, storytelling. I've kind of seen it all before. I've kind of, you know, made a lot of films, you know, and these kind of forms are kind of exhausted and they're getting tired and retread, and television just sort of, you know, takes the life blood out of them. So this was quite an exciting thing for me because I found a whole different way to tell a story in something that seemed perfect for the material I was trying to convey to the audience.
Absolutely perfect, yeah. I want to touch upon a couple of points that I believe are gross misconceptions about the film, and of course they're being perpetrated by people who haven't even seen it. But let me put forth a couple of the main criticisms and get your response to them, if I may. One of the criticisms is that it paints all American soldiers as monsters.
Well, that's untrue, of course, and I very specifically, you know, point out, I mean, they say they're bad apples, and incidences like this are always motivated by one guy that's the wild card, and I spent a long time sort of delineating that. Anytime, you know, whether it's in Cold Blood or the Yablonsky murders, there's always the guy that pushes it too far. Mm. And these guys would never have done this by themselves. It's a sequence of events, and then suddenly there's this guy that's just a little tweaked, a little different than everybody else. And that was, of course, very much the story of Casualties of War. Mm. and very much the story in this case, because the guy, you know, when they say the bottom of the gumbo barrel, I mean, we're recruiting people that we normally would not recruit. I mean, that's another secret the Army doesn't want to tell us about. You know, we're dealing with people that are a little questionable to begin with.
Yeah.
And this particular guy had all kinds of psychological problems and was on his way of being, rejected by the Army before this incident, you know. And, of course, the endless cover-up is, of course, what the Army always does in these instances until, you know, it's so humiliated and everybody's talking so much that they can't cover it up anymore, which is the story of My Lai and Haditha and, you know, all this stuff.
I think it's, anyone that actually views the film, I think it's very obvious that I believe your film is incredibly fair-minded and every viewpoint is represented within the film. I mean, there's an amazing sequence where they unknowingly shoot and kill a pregnant woman.
Yes, based on an actual incident.
Yes, and then the conversation that follows, you know, one of them is absolutely horrified and criticizing the shooter, and the shooter says, "It's my job. How am I to know?"
And the sarge is the one that sort of shuts them all down. I mean, that's a real sarge.
Oh,
I mean, that guy is a real sergeant.
Mike
Figaro,
right?
He's in the Army. Yeah. Mike, he's, you know, in the Army. He's still in the Army. He's been to Afghanistan and Iraq. And that's that. I didn't write that. He just jumped up in the middle of it and did what a sergeant would do. You know, shut up. This is what happens. This is what you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
Now go to bed and stop arguing, basically.
Yeah, incredible sequence. The other criticism is that releasing this film, this is just a crazy crazy criticism here. Releasing the film while we're still embroiled in the conflict can somehow prove deadly to our troops.
Ridiculous.
I mean,
we're doing so much damage over there. Do you think this film is going to have any effect in relationship to cluster bombs? I doubt it.
Yeah. But you make no secret of the fact that the single most important objective in making this film for you was to inspire an end to the war.
Yeah, because we don't see any of this stuff. This is why everybody's getting so steamed up about this film. They're like horrified about how could soldiers be this way and how can you show these pictures? Well, I lived through Vietnam. I saw all this stuff over and over again.
Yeah.
And it's just shows how well the Pentagon has kept all this stuff away from everybody that they're seemingly so shocked by it now.
But what do you believe is the capacity for the film to provoke a positive change, especially among what I would have to say is a very jaded populace?
Well, always the images. The, you know, if you can get the images out there and you know, people are disturbed enough about it, then they'll start asking some questions. And all they have to do is go on the internet like I did and they'll find all the answers.
Wow.
You know, this is a movie that, you know, you say, this really happened? Guys are really like this? Just get your Google search engine and take a look.
Right. You're absolutely right.
I wanted to touch upon a little bit, because you've said that your film itself has been redacted, the final montage showing the real-life pictures of slain Iraqis. And I read something interesting in Mark Cuban's blog, and I want you to tell me if this is the norm or not. Mark Cuban said in his response to a letter from Bill O'Reilly's show, I believe, he said, "I didn't read the script or know all that much about it before we greenlit it." Is that unusual for the main backer of a film? And was it
It had nothing to do with it. This is a program they have, you know. They give established filmmakers, you know, like $5 million. Do anything you want. Just do it on high definition.
Yeah.
Mark Cuban's not paying any attention to it. The only time he kind of woke up is, I guess, when some lawyer said, "Have you seen these pictures that are in the movie?" And all of a sudden they went, "Oh, my God, oh, we can't have anything to do with this."
So it was understood from the get-go that that montage would be included.
Absolutely. That montage, if you put, you know, Iraq casualties images into a search engine, you'll come up with a dozen montages like this. They're all over the Internet. This is where I got the idea. So I, you know, said to the producers, let's get the most, you know, emotional pictures we can get that nobody can seem to get published.
Mm.
You know, and we assembled a whole bunch of them. We, you know, HDNet lawyers wrote the releases for everybody, and you know, everything was going along, and you know, we had insurance and everything. And then suddenly somebody, I'm sure up high in the company, said, "Oh my God, have you seen these pictures?" And then,
yeah,
of course, just and like any big media company, they say, we can't show these. We can't be associated with this. And that's what happened.
Well, how ironic is it that they're upset? There's all this uproar, not about anything you've done, not about anything Brian De Palma's done, but about pictures that you had literally nothing to do with.
No, they were completely, they were assembled by basically by Eric Schwab, my associate. And he was over there well before I arrived. He talked to the Iraqi war photographers. He's the one that sort of collected all the images, and then I had an editor, picture editor at the New York Times. I said, "Send me all the pictures that you can't get published." And from that, we assembled the montage. And we wanted it to be, you know, very strong, because if we're involved over there and we're dropping bombs and we're killing people, I'd like to see it, because I'm paying for it.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's true.
How does this movie place for you in the scope of your career? Do you feel that this could be the most important film that you've ever done?
Oh, that's kind of hard to say. It's hard to have perspective like that. It's very exciting for me, because I think I found this whole different form. And as you know, in my movies, I'm constantly interested in, you know, the form and how to convey stuff through different forms. And, you know, I'm a bit of a computer nut, and very into this kind of technology. So I'm interested in all these new forms, whether they be computer games or stuff going on the Internet. And as I said, I'm getting kind of bored with the traditional filmic form, because, you know, I've done a lot of movies, and we have a great history of the use of this form. It's almost like, you know, writing opera. I mean, you know, the time may have passed, you know, for this form, and they're new forms, and I'm kind of excited about exploring them.
Mm-hmm. Would you say in general that this is something that interests me, watching your films? And I find especially in your later work a more hopeful kind of thread. I'm thinking about Mission to Mars, and would you say that you're more of a hopeful or a cynic?
Well, I guess you would have to say that one becomes a cynic because one's hopes for the best are dashed so terribly.
Yeah.
But of course, one starts out sort of, you know, expecting the best and hoping for the best, and then when you're confronted with the reality on the ground, you go, "Oh my God, I can't believe this is happening. How can people be like this?"
Yeah.
You know.
What amazes me about you, though, is it seems that you still have that same fire in the belly as you did when you first started out, and you.
Yeah, I get very upset by this. I mean, you know, it's we're harming a lot of people. You know, we're going to have generations of soldiers scarred that are going to be wandering around VA hospitals. I lived up in Northern California near a VA hospital, and you see all those Vietnam vets wandering around with the 1,000-mile stare. I mean, my father was over in Vietnam, you know, doing surgeries. I mean, I've seen all this stuff, you know, and of course, nobody, you'll never see it on, you know, your mainstream media. Everybody, you know, that was, of course, the scandal of Walter Reed. I mean, they don't want to let you know what's happening. They just want to show you the guys with the, you know, incredibly new limbs and hopping around and how happy they all are.
Yeah.
But the scars of this war, all those 30, 40, 50,000 guys that came back with some terrible injury, this is going to go on for generations, and the trauma
years.
Of this war on this generation of soldiers is going to be a very sad thing to watch.
Yeah, and that's another thing that another criticism, that it's too soon to make a film about our conflict over there. But when you watch this film, it's clearly a cry to stop the war, and in that case, you're just hoping that it's not too late.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've been, we had an election where we tried to get them to stop this war. We don't have to have seem to have much of an effect until we have the next election.
Yeah.
But who knows how long we're going to be there? And with the wind down for Vietnam went on forever.
Okay, we have to close out this segment. Actually, we're movie geeks after all, so I have to ask you a few movie geek questions.
Okay. Go geeks.
I'm thinking about David Lynch. You know, he took the new digital technology with his last picture, and he mm-hmm. says that he never wants to use film again. And I'm wondering how you took to the HD format, and if you're anxious to return to that for future.
Yeah, I am anxious to return to it. I don't want it to be a substitute for film. Like in any new media forms, you want it to find its own particular
identity.
Exactly,
yeah.
Identity. And I'm just starting to experiment with this. I have a lot more feelings about what's going on with this war. I could make another film like this. I like it because I can do it quickly. I'm sort of left completely alone. And I've got a lot, you know, I've always felt that, you know, once you've developed all these tools, you better have something to say. And that's what's so missing in so much of our contemporary cinema. Nobody has anything to say, even though they've spent years developing all kinds of techniques.
Technical, right. I agree with you completely. Now, I saw this on Jeff Baran's website, the De Palma All Abode, and Jeff is fantastic. His website on you is fantastic as well. It was reported that you recently completed a script titled Shoot the Messenger. Can you give us any information on that?
As a matter of fact, I'm not writing anymore because of the writer's strike, but yes, indeed, I did complete a script tentatively entitled Shoot the Messenger. Yeah, I'm very interested in dealing with the sort of George Orwell take on this war, and showing how the by things being re-edited and how myths are created and all the spinning that went on to sell this war. And I have a lot of thoughts about using this digital form to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll be first in line for that film, just to let you know. I want to know a little bit about your next film, which I believe is a prequel of sorts to The Untouchables.
Well, again, we are still trying to cast this. We've had this together with a bunch of different actors over the last couple of years, and things keep on falling in and out. I have nothing to report. We thought we had it together again. I don't know if it's going to pull itself together soon enough for me to shoot next year, because I have to shoot it in the wintertime because there's a Saturday night, rather a Valentine's Day massacre, and it's got to be done in the cold in February.
Mm.
So if I can't get it together in another month or so, I'm going to go off and do something else.
Well, I heard that you were trying to fill the spot of the young Al Capone, and you were looking for someone strong and sexy, and I just want to throw my hat in the ring.
Absolutely. Send your resume. The problem is I don't think we can raise any foreign money on your name. Maybe wrong.
Give it time.
I could be wrong.
Give it time. You might be able to.
Yes, could be.
I just have to ask you one more question before we let you go, because obviously you're an idol for all of us, a great inspiration, and another one of my cinematic idols, and every time I get a chance to ask about him, I seize the opportunity, is Al Pacino. And you've, of course, worked with him on Scarface and Carlito's Way. What can you tell me about the nature of that collaboration and what makes Pacino such a special talent?
Well, he's one of the unusual actors of his generation. He keeps going back to the stage. That is what actors should do. This, movie acting is a form of acting. But, to really sort of hone your skills, you really should go back on the stage where you have, a certain amount of time to mold and create your character. And that's what makes him the great actor that he is. He's always going back to the stage. He's always, testing himself and expanding what he can do. He's, very curious. He likes to work with different people, to get different input. And plus, he's, you know, got a great sense of humor.
Yeah. I hear that he absolutely, the relationship with the director is of paramount importance to him. The open communication and the engagement between director and actor is something he really depends upon. Where you hear that other
Al worked with all kinds of directors in all kinds of different forms. He's kind of self-contained, he's like one of those great actors that, you know, you sort of let them do what they do and, try to get the cables out of their way and watch what they do and figure out a way to maximize what they're doing with the placement of the camera, which is what he really likes about me, is that, you know, it's like that very complicated shot in Carlito's Way up and down the escalators. I mean, only he and I working together could pull something like that off. Because normally people just, you know, shoot Al in, you know, medium close-ups, I mean, because he's so dynamic, but... You know, to me, that's not really directing. Anybody can shoot over the shoulders and close-ups, and, you know, if you have a good script and a great actor, it'll all sort of work out somehow. But you've always got to figure out how to visually maximize the potential of what your actor's doing, and you have to watch him and see how he moves through a space and then figure out exactly where to put the camera to so that he can do what he does. And that was very true, like in the boardroom scene in... Scarface, was to give him that space in order to work.
Mr. De Palma, we can't tell you how much your movies mean to us, and we could talk to you for 3 or 4 days about your the rest of the films on your resume, but we know you need to go, but thank you so much for spending this time with us, and please come back to us whenever you'd like.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, geeks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now. Thank you.
Bye-bye.